My name is Alvin. I'm an alcoholic.
Alvin.
Very grateful for the precious gift of sobriety. We still have that credit card up here. Well, Joan took about two of my jokes, so we're going to kind of bypass that. But anyway, I want to thank I want to thank all of you, actually, for your warm welcome. And it's good to know that AA is alive and well in Georgia, I'll tell you that. Your work at your home groups, our work at our home groups, is really what makes AA tick. You know, it's what invited me when I first came to Alcoholics Anonymous, uncertain whether or not I could live without a drink. It was people just like you. And, you know, you kind of sit through the thick and thin in the beginning. You're wondering if you're in the right spot or not. And on occasion, you go to some of these large gatherings. And there was one large gathering in particular where it must have been thousands of people at a convention. And the speaker was going on and on. And you know you're in trouble when he's still in grammar school and he's 20 minutes into his talk. You know you're in trouble. And a guy in the second row gets up. About a half hour into his talk, he gets up, he heads out the door, and the speaker is winding down close to over an hour later. The fellow comes back in and sits in the chair, and finally the meeting comes to a close. Well, the speaker spotted this guy leaving, and he spotted him coming back. So he sought him out after the meeting was over. And he said to the fellow, "Hey, I noticed you got up and left during my talk. Where did you go?" And the guy says, "I went to get a haircut." And the speaker said, "You went to get a haircut? Why didn't you go to get a haircut before the meeting started?" And the fellow replied, "I didn't need a haircut before the meeting started." All the barbershops are closed. There's no place to run. Oh, gosh. I am a member of the West End High Noon Group in Long Beach, New York. We meet on Saturday mornings, free bagels. If you get there early enough, it starts at 10 o'clock. We have a closed meeting in one room and a beginner's meeting in the other. And on Thursday nights, we do step meetings out of the Big Book. And we start at 7:15, no bagels. And it's probably the worst coffee you'll ever have in AA. So I'll warn you ahead of time. And unfortunately, we don't meet in that place anymore because when the Hurricane Sandy came in, we got clobbered. We're a small barrier island in Long Island. And we got wiped out. And finally, we had some meetings other than in people's homes. And I remember one of the first meetings we had, I just got back into the house and we didn't have any electricity or water. They told you not to use the water, but, you know, if you put it on the stove, if you were lucky enough to have a gas stove, the gas was still operating so you could boil water and you can make tea or coffee like that. And I was seeing people, they started dribbling back into the community and they said, "Boy, it would be great to have a meeting." And some young people had approached me that lived right around the block, and they had just started two young people's meetings not too far away. And they said, we haven't had a meeting in 10 days. I said, "Well, why don't we have a meeting here today?" Thinking it would just be the kids around the block, a couple of the old-timers that I know from my home group, and we'll plop in the living room. You know, I live in a small cottage right by the ocean, you know, bungalow. So there's a curfew, and we have to get off the street by 6 o'clock. There's National Guard at each entranceway into the island. I mean, we were a mess. And I tell this story really not to tell you stories about me, but to tell you stories about you, about Alcoholics Anonymous. So as the afternoon approaches, my wife is cleaning up outside, and she comes inside and she says to me, "There's a bunch of teenagers outside. I don't know what they're doing, but they're smoking cigarettes and they're talking, and I don't know what they're doing here. A bunch of them." So I I go out and I look over the porch, and I recognize a few of the young guys from the young people's group, you know, and I invite them up. And slowly but surely, it was miraculous. When I tell you, it was what we wound up having to do is push the furniture, not that there's a lot of furniture, but push the furniture against the wall, and we started sitting in a circle, and it went round and round, and then most of the people wound up in the kitchen onto the porch. And then a woman arrived with two daughters, both young teenagers, and they were shaken, and most of the community was all shook up. And the one girl whispers in my ear, do you mind if my mother, she's in Al-Anon, if she stays? So before the meeting starts, I ask all of the AA members, do you mind if we make this an open meeting so mom can stay? Everybody said, sure, that would be just fine. And so we started with a fellow that had, I think he just had 51 years of sobriety, and we started going around the room. And at first it was a lot of, you know, people trying to get comfortable and whatnot. But slowly but surely, you could hear a pin drop in that house. There must have been 50-plus people in a room, gosh, smaller than this little area that Joan and I are standing. And it finally gets around. The girls are right towards the tail end as we went round robin. And we had to hustle up because everybody had to get off the streets by 6 o'clock. And so one of the girls say, I'm so happy to be here. She starts crying, saying that she hadn't been to a meeting and that she was new. And the sister says more or less the same thing. She was the senior statesman. She had about 9 months at that time. So then it gets to mom. And there was a pause, just like there is right now. And you could hear the silence. You know how sometimes you could hear the silence? And she says, I want to thank all of you for saving the lives of my daughters. Thank you for having this meeting here today, all of you. So we tried to continue the meeting, and we more or less broke up after that. And that image in my mind has stayed with me. It has been emblazoned in my memory, because that is the power of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's it. When a mother who thinks that she's going to lose the very lives of the daughters that she brought into the world can look into the eyes of the people much, much older than not only her daughters, but she herself, and say, thank you for saving their lives. That is our fellowship. That is Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's the fellowship that miraculously extended its hand when I first came and said, keep coming. And I am not a poster child for AA. I tried and failed so many times in the beginning. So many times. I don't know what it was. I had more trouble than a man could ever bargain for. And yet, once the wrinkles got out of my belly and the people that were chasing me and were looking for me were a little further in the background, I decided to stay away from you and to return to the old life, not thinking that I would drink again, just that, you know, that's enough. You know, I put some distance between me and the last battle. And inevitably, without warning, without any forethought, just like the founders talked about in the early literature, there's this strange mental blank spot. I can't tell you how it happened. I can tell you where it happened and when it happened. The next thing I knew, time after time, I was either pounding my hand on the bar saying, how the hell did this happen again? Or I was in some parking lot, not sure how I had gotten there, if I had driven, if somebody dropped me off, if I were supposed to go home. And it's funny, you know, when I was a kid, I was a nervous kid. I was born in a Salvation Army in Jersey City, New Jersey. My mother was an unwed military woman who was in the Navy. And in those days, 50-plus years ago, they gave you the boot. And so they gave her the boot, and she didn't know where to go. So she went to her brother's house. And He put her up, and the Salvation Army in those days had these little houses that they had for women and who were by themselves and pregnant and uncertain what to do. And doctors would give their attention pro bono. And so that's where I was born. I was born in one of those hospitals, right by Christ Hospital, in fact. The attending physicians were from there. And I was adopted by Alvin and Mary Zazula. It was kind of prearranged back in those days. There wasn't a lot of formality. The doctor knew the judge knew the doctor. There was some papers signed, and off I went. And the image was this that I had always been told, that after a few days, my mother handed me through the window of a car to who became the woman who gave birth to me, handed me to this couple in a car who I've known all my life and as my mom and dad. And the story goes that she walked very quietly, almost into the sunset down the block. Kind of, she was very thin and her clothing didn't fit well and she had bobby socks on, as my mother tells the tale, and the dress didn't quite fit. And my parents gave me everything a kid could want. My father was a baker. My mother was a Russian seamstress. They both dropped out of school when they were in grammar school, and never did a day go by that I didn't have a roof over my head or food on the table. And yet alcoholism will rob us of everything. The people that we care most about, the people that have given us literally the shirt off their backs, I turned on them, and when the time came, I robbed from them. I not only took their possessions, I took that sacred gift that all of us get walking the face of this earth, and that is I robbed them of their God-given peace of mind. The worry that a parent has when a child is missing or they don't know where he is. And that went on for years because I started drinking in the schoolyard when I was about 12, 13 years old. And it was a lot of fun. It was terrific. And that nervous kid, it took the knot out of my stomach and I could kick the pebble out of my shoe. And I felt a little bit better. You know? It worked. It really did. It worked great. It worked great and it was exciting. And we drank with the older guys. And I played a lot of hoop in those days. And so those guys would go to the liquor store, or they'd get Freddie the bum to go to the liquor store, and Freddie would get a little cut of the action, and it was terrific. It was terrific. It was just like those songs in those days, you know, chasing women and drinking, and it was fantastic. I couldn't wait to do it again. I'd get as sick as a dog, even when I was young. Even when I was young, the drink didn't agree with me. And yet I you know, you bounce back when you're a kid. You bounce back. It's unbelievable. The next day, you know, you get a little food in your stomach. You forget what happened the night before, all the throwing up and maybe black and blues or scrapes or whatnot. And so it went on for a while. And it's funny because I really loved playing ball. I loved it. I was one of those kids where in the winter where it would snow, you would see me going down the block with a shovel over my shoulder and a basketball under my arm. And I'd shovel out the foul area into the basket. And that's where I'd be. Happy as a lark, all by myself. And I was lucky enough to play on a decent team. I was the little white point guard, in case you can't figure that out. I was lucky enough to play on a team that had a lot of big fellas that played great hoop, so I kind of rode on their coattails. And I wanted to go on to college and this and that, but it's funny, alcoholism, you know, not only takes away the people that we love, it takes away our ambitions, our hopes, our dreams, our talents, right? It's just gone. It's the great eraser. It's the great eraser. And sure enough, the time came where what limited physical ability that God blessed me with and the drinking collided and the physical ability went downhill and the drinking continued on. And nothing could stop it. It was a whirlwind. You know, and the illness is interesting. It's like most illnesses. As you get older, it grows worse. It just, both body, mind, and spirit, I mean, it gets worse. And it gets worse, you know. And I remember how, 18 years old, I remember the day I got into a junior college. And I remember the first day up at school, the guy says to me that I'm rooming with, he says, you know, they'll serve us down at the bar right off campus. So off we went. And of course, when I drank, I had blackouts since I was a young kid. I mean, I knew nothing different than that. I thought it was a package deal, right? That you drank and you tried to put the pieces back together, both physically and mentally, you know? What happened last night? And it just, it was a collision of a desire versus an illness that is far beyond the point of any human aid. And it was lonely, and it broke my spirit, and I started hating other people. It's an odd thing. Alcoholism kind of takes manifestations in the strangest ways. You start blaming everybody under the sun for your misfortunes, and slowly but surely, your once what was a huge world turned out to be this ever smaller. It just kept decreasing in size and shrinking. Drinking's a lonely game. I don't care what age you are, it's a lonely game. You know, and I'd have to drink so hard just to close my eyes and get a little sleep. Do you remember those days? Just to close your eyes. And then there'd be no telling when you'd wake up or what condition you'd be in. Usually I was sweating bullets, soaking wet. And slowly but surely the body starts deteriorating and you start losing your control of your functions. And when I was a kid, I had a paper route. I've had a paper route my whole life. I'm still delivering papers, but it's true. That's what I do for a living. And I never thought of it that way, but it's true. And I had a morning route. I had a morning route, and it was right in the neighborhood, and it was about a 6-block radius, you know. And it was right on, it was in Jersey, in Union City, right across from Manhattan, directly across. If you went to the Lincoln Tunnel and shot right up when you got to Jersey, that's where I lived. And as I delivered the paper, I would see men and women. I would see them in vestibules and on stoops, outside the gin mill. And I knew who they were. I went to school with their children, or I would walk their dogs. And I would say to myself, how could a man or a woman allow themselves to get so low? How could they, why would they do that to their family, to themselves, you know? The degradation of alcoholism. It's brutal. It's brutal. And I swore I would never, ever be like that. Ever be like that. How could they? How could they turn around and behave that way and treat the people that supposedly they love and they're supposed to care for? And yet the day came. Many days came like that. And as the drinking got worse, my ability to bounce back, I needed a longer period of time to lick my wounds, you know? Because the physical toll of alcoholic drinking is enormous. I mean, I think it's really untold and immeasurable. You just don't know. And before I was able to really find my way, I said, you know what? I'll start drinking on weekends, and I was able to pull that off for a short period of time. Then I said to myself, I'll get married and have some children and get a good job and behave myself. I'll behave myself. I'll tell you a couple of stories that I'm not proud of, and they're kind of bittersweet in a way. The night before I was to be married, I was in a car accident in the limousine because my friend insisted that the driver get in the back with me because he wanted to drive the limo. So we veered off the LIE in Long Island, and we had to wait for the ambulance to come and somehow convince the guy before the cops got there to please drop us off at the next exit. And I was about an hour and a half late to my own wedding. I mean, you talk about the what lies in the future for this poor woman, right? Unbelievable. Not too long after that, we got pregnant. And I say we got pregnant because I went to Lamaze class, and I know it's the we thing, and I was good. I went every Tuesday, and I brought the pillow, and I knew how to say breathe, and we had a little bag ready. We had everything all set, you know? And the day comes, and I'm nowhere to be found. Nowhere to be found. So I finally, they get hold of me. I'm not far away. I'm in some bar in Westchester County. And so I hop in the car and I am just shattered. And Terry's in the delivery room and I'm stinking drunk. I mean, I can't even walk straight. And I remember they wouldn't let me in. They told me to stay in the hallway. And I kind of fell asleep and my first baby was born, my daughter Nikki. And I hated myself. You know, the weight of our own actions lie on the shoulders of an alcoholic heavier than any societal condemnation can be, anything that somebody accuses us of doing. That my own actions were like cinder blocks on my shoulder. And so I not only started hating myself, I hated zip code areas if they were wealthy zip code areas. I hated certain parishes. I hated neighborhoods. I hated life, you know? That boomerang that Bill talks about in his story. That boomerang. And by now I had to drink. The putting it off to weekend was over. And I was separated from my wife and child, and I wound up in a shelter, and then I took a step up and wound up in the YMCA in White Plains, and they have one of these bulletproof glasses that they have in front of the teller, and you slide a $5 bill underneath, and they slip you a key, and you go down the hallway, and you share a bathroom with 12 other lugs. And you say to yourself as you're sitting in your little cot and you have this little sink over there. Of course, I have a bottle in hand. I'm wondering to myself, how did it ever get so crazy? What happened? When I was that kid in the schoolyard with everybody else chasing women and drinking and playing some hoops and having a ball and shaking it off and had hopes and dreams and I don't know how it turned, but I can tell you that there are some significant signposts if we just stop and take measure of our lives. The landscape of an alcoholic's life is loaded with them, loaded with them. There comes points in our drinking where we start drinking to escape the effect of the drink just prior because it either didn't work or it was distasteful, or maybe just a little more will do the trick, you know? We just then we're in that cage, that hamster wheel, where we keep going around and around. And I sought hospitalization for the first time because of my drinking. I would get banged up, I'd get broken bones, and I'd be in accidents, and I'd be in trouble with the law, and I've spared you that part of the story, and but I actually sought medical help for the first time, and I was in my late 20s. And I was falling apart at the seams. I thought I was losing my mind. My heart felt as though it was going to beat out of my chest. I remember lying in bed and pushing as hard as I could between the spaces between your ribs covering your heart, trying to keep it in place, convinced I was going to die right then and there. And there wasn't enough booze in the world to douse that. And I was a shivering wreck of a man. No hope, no dreams, incapable of holding a job now. I was flopping at somebody's house I had no right to be in, you know. So I, you know, the people, God bless medical people, you know. I mean, despite all of our lies and denials, they take us back, hoping that this will be the time. You know, maybe this will work this time. And so I tried to reconcile with my wife, and we decided to have another child. That's always the answer. And Michael was born. It's a few years later. And it was the same old thing. I was there for his birth, but I wasn't much use to anybody. And I remember Terry would leave, and I'd be home alone with the kids, and I'd have to fight every fiber in my being not to get too drunk while I had these babies, you know? And I couldn't take it. I mean, the nerves and the anxiety and the worry and the self-hatred, I couldn't take it, so I left them. You know, in those days, people would say, well, you were having a nervous breakdown. And I thought I was having a nervous breakdown. And it's, I know it seems strange to you when I tell you this, but I could, that trouble I just described, and it's only the tip of the iceberg, I did not connect the trouble in my life to the drinking. I married the wrong woman. I grew up in the wrong neighborhood. You know, I felt sorry for myself because I had physical problems. I went to the wrong school. I did this. It was my parents' fault. I was adopted. I was very dramatic about that. I remember I was on a real tear one time in Arizona, and the Mormons have this genealogy center in Mesa, Arizona, and I'm shattered, and I'm going to go in there, and I'm going to find my roots. The Mormons don't drink. So you walk in there, and I smell like I just left the bar, and the good people there were trying to persuade me that it would be better perhaps to come back another day to look for my roots, you know? And all of us, I don't know about you, but when I get good and drunk, I turn into an attorney. Either that or a doctor. And I know my rights, and I know what's wrong with you and what would work best. And I remember one time I'm in some, you know, I had no medical insurance anymore, so you wind up in these hospitals or whatever the hell they call them. And I'm doing a Thorazine shuffle down the hall in those slippers, the one-size-fits-all slippers, you know, and your rear end's hanging out of the rope, right? And I'm doing the Thor, and I'm counseling my fellow patients. No, really, I was holding court. I said, you know, perhaps if they just tweak the medication a bit and then you sought aftercare treatment, I think all things would be good for you. I disagree with their diagnosis. You know? Then it occurred to me that there were no doorknobs on my side of the door, and there were an obvious architectural defect, another problem at the hospital, and there was chicken wire behind you couldn't open, the windows didn't open properly, and there was no knives to cut anything with, imagine, you know? Oh, man. We're funny that way. We could be on our last breath, and the ego is the last thing to go, isn't it? You're down to your last breath. And you say, by golly, you know, oh, leave it to an alcoholic that, you know, that he would fight, he would demand that it is his right to live a life of futility. He demands it. And you cannot deny him of that. Regardless of how much a failure he may be, it's his right to live that life as a failure. And that was me. It was my right. And the hospitals, you know, my time away from the hospitals grew shorter and shorter. It grew shorter and shorter. Some of you know what I mean. You can't stay out on the street that long. The booze catches up to you. It catches up to you. And finally, I wound up in a mental ward in Northern Westchester Hospital in Mount Kisco, New York. Another mistake on the part of my medical treatment, but it's exactly where I needed to be. I thought they had a detox there, to be honest with you, and they said, oh, come on in. Come on in. And I'll never forget this. So, you know, 'tis himself. It's an old Irish saying, meaning he thinks too much of himself. So there I am, right? In bad condition once again. They keep himself waiting in the waiting room. It must have been 15 minutes. So I storm out of the joint. I had hit a bottle right under the bushes as I walked in, and I took what I hoped to be my last drink, God willing. But I put that bottle, what little was left, back under the bush, and I marched up there. And I remember looking out those windows that was in those rooms that they kept us in, and they kept us separated from one another. And I mentioned the chicken wire behind it. So every so often, the light from the moon would come in, and it was in December in 1988. And I remember looking out the window, and I said probably the most sincere prayer I've ever said in my life up to that point, and probably inclusive of today. I will do anything if you stop the madness. I will do anything. Not certain to whom or to what I was praying, knowing full well what the madness was, though, because we do know what the madness is. You know those secrets that you won't tell anyone, that life of futility that you live, that aloneness, nobody knows. And what was once a cinder block was now many cinder blocks. I had hated the man that I had become. And I thought about suicide prior to that, but, you know, being a coward in every right, I chickened out twice. I had some really terrific plans on killing myself. One time I ran out of money in a bar, which is always a bad spot to be in. And I decided, that's it, I've had it. So I head to the train tracks and I get to the platform and I start walking away from the platform. And as you leave the platform, I'm figuring I'll walk right into a train and that'll be that. And, you know, woe is he. And everyone will be better off for it, you know. Meanwhile, there was an order of protection to keep me away from the kids, which I forgot to mention to you, you know. And I had not paid any child support or been present or sent birthday cards. I had become those men on those stoops, right? When I was delivering the newspaper when I was a kid, I became one of them. And I knew the darkness that an alcoholic, and only an alcoholic, knows. And so when I said that prayer, the next day, people like yourselves come in. Must have been a commitment, an ongoing commitment. They brought an AA meeting in. Now, I had been to more AA meetings than you could shake a stick. And I would go to groups. And it's funny, when you're new, you're very particular as to who you will allow to save your life. Let that roam around a little bit. Too young, too old, very inconvenient time. Very inconvenient time. Saturdays, come on, Saturdays. Saturdays. Very particular who I was going to allow to save me. Oh, my gosh. Typical, though, right? Typical. Same guy that was holding court with his rear end hanging out of the gown, doing a Thorazine shuffle, now is particular as to which group I will become a member of. Do your big favor, you know? Oh, so I started going around to meetings here and there, slow but sure. Scared to death to drink. I wasn't sleeping at night. My stomach was all fouled up. I was sick. I was very sick. Very sick. And lied through my teeth to get a part-time job in the Bronx. Used an old friend of mine. He used his car. We called it the Hoopty. It was a Pontiac, I think, Firebird. And, you know, they roll pretty close to the ground to begin with. But when you take into account that there's been no maintenance on the car and there's no shock absorbers, this thing, if you hit a pebble, there's sparks would be coming out of the tailpipe from hitting the ground, and the driver's side door didn't work, and you had to get in from the passenger side, and it was a stick shift, so you know how that goes, and you couldn't put your feet down on the passenger side because it had rusted out on the floorboard, and there was like two or three layers of cardboard box there, and that was my car to get me to that part-time job that I lied through my teeth to get. And every day I went in, I was afraid that they'd find out that I lied on the application. Or, like a good alcoholic, references furnished upon request. Who shall I tell them to call? It's the last thing to go, I'm telling you. It's the last thing to go. Who shall they call? And I found a group of people in Mount Vernon, New York, on Gramenet Avenue, next to a strip joint called Sue's Rendezvous. I kid you not, up 22 marble steps through a door which you had to put your shoulder into to get into the joint. And it was shaped like a bowling alley, the hall. And up front, there was a speaker's table. And in the back, there was a little kitchen. And there were chairs set up like pinochle sets, four chairs to a table, like we were in Vegas or something. Yeah, and they had little lanterns on the wall, you know. And the old-timers told me that way, way, way back when, a guy by the name of Jack Brennan started the group. That name may ring a bell. They actually had a jukebox in there, so I missed that part. And I wandered up there, and it was, I guess it was sometime in April. So I had a couple of, months under my belt. And I waltz into the kitchen, and the first thing they try and do, it was a lunchtime meeting, they were trying to pawn off these cheese sandwiches for a buck, you know, and I knew they were up to something. So I said, no thanks. The guy says, well, if you don't have the money, just take the sandwich, go and sit down. You don't have to worry about anything. Decaf is over there, regular's over there. I said, thanks a lot. And the next day I come back. And I said, how do you join this group? What do you do? I hear at the beginning of the meeting, if you want to join the group, see the guy in the kitchen. The guy says, yeah, tell me your sobriety date. And I said, well, you know, I'm kind of cloudy on that because I wound up in a hospital sometime in December, but then I got out at the tail end of January. Well, make it January 23rd. Don't sweat it. All right, January 23rd it is. Fine. I didn't like this guy already. Then he says to me, starting today, even though you have 62 days, starting today, you will do your 90 days in this group so we could keep an eye on you. So you don't have to worry about anything. You don't have to talk. You don't have to speak. You just say, my name's Alvin. I'm an alcoholic. Or if you don't even want to say that, you get a pass. You don't have to say anything. But don't say anything else either. And it was good. It was good because it got me off the hook. I didn't have to worry about coming up with some Nobel Prize-winning answer to these questions, you know. And they didn't ask me for references. And then at the tail end of the month, they would have what we call anniversaries. You guys call them birthdays, right? And this is what would get me. People would come and they would bring their families, generations. They'd bring children. They'd bring grandparents or parents. They'd bring husbands and wives. And I would sit there and I would think to myself, that's nice for them. That's good for them. That'll never happen for me. That'll never happen. Too much has happened. Too many sins have been committed. Too many broken promises. Too much. It's too much. But I took note of what was taking place in front of me. And I would see a child hand their mother or their father their coin, representing the amount of sobriety, how many years they had. And I would that picture would stay in my mind. And then I'd look on the shades and I saw that death-defying making amends step. And I would think of them, I would think of these celebrations and say to myself, I don't have the guts, number one. Number two, I'll never have the opportunity. But I wound up asking a man to help me. And he told me he'd share everything he's experienced with me under one condition. Of course, being the optimist that I am, I said, oh, here we go. And he says, once we're done, you pass it on to the next guy. Okay? I said, all right. Never thinking that one day I would be in a position where a man would ask me for help. Never would I have ever even pictured that. And so we began the work together. We went through the steps quickly. No dilly-dally. I mean, read Bill's story. He's still in the bed. He's acquainting his friend with some of his more objectionable traits, you know. And then he's making a list of the people he's got to square with. So we got right on this, you know. And the drinking was the great persuader, you know. Just like, you know, that there's some wonderful lines in our literature that, geez, how did they know I was coming? They must have known when they wrote these things, because there's this one line that constantly rings true to me, and that is that what was a flimsy reed of hope has turned out to be the loving and all-powerful hand of God. And I stand here today a sober man, and I'm telling you that flimsy reed of hope has turned out to be the loving and all-powerful hand of God. And so I'll tell you what happened after that. I get a phone call one day, and it's the child whose birth I missed, who was now 8 years of age. And she says, hey, Dad, can I come over this weekend? It had been a long time. I said, sure, Nick, is it all right with your mom? Yeah, I already asked her. It's okay. A couple of weekends after that, and guess what? Not once did it cross my mind that I would have to fight getting too drunk while she was in my care. So something was taking place in my life. And you know, no matter what speaker you hear or what state you're in or what group you're from or the time of day of the meeting, you'll hear two words in just about everyone's story who was once like me. Those magic words that we can't really seem to put any more definition to other than saying something happened. Something happened. And I wasn't fighting the drink anymore. You know how it tells us in the book that we're not cocky, we're not afraid, we're put in a position of neutrality of sorts? It was unbelievable for a guy like me. Unbelievable. And a few weeks passed, and she brought her brother with her. That was a challenge with the two of them. But I remember. And I was in so much debt, and I couldn't get a job. I had just desecrated what little opportunity I had in the field that I was working in and still do. But slowly but surely things started happening, and as the days went into months and the months went into years, the kids eventually got even with me, and when they were teenagers, they moved in. They got even. I don't know if they know they got even, but they got even. And I would take them to those celebrations that I told you about, that anniversaries or birthdays would be celebrated, and I would bring my children now. And not only to mine, but to my friends and my fellow group members. And my sponsor would take me all over the damn place. We'd go to meetings. I didn't even know where we were going. We were talking about this at lunch. I'll be in front of your house. Be ready. Not as though my social calendar was full and I had to make room, you know. And off we went. Many things have taken place. My daughter, through the years, has struggled terribly with drug addiction. Terribly heartbreaking. For about 2 months while she was 16 years of age, she was missing. She was running drugs for a family in New Mexico. And a friend of a friend who was in the FBI, she got arrested and let go, more or less, promising never to go back to that. And to this day, she struggles. But what has taken place in all those many years is that she's had children. And so now my grandchildren come with me, and they stay with me, and they go to those celebrations. And I wonder sometimes if new people look at them and say, that'll never be me. I'll never have my grandchildren here. Or my children here. And I'm here to tell you, I'm here to look into the eyes of every man and woman here and tell them that God makes hard terms with no one who seeks Him. Never has a soul been turned away. Not in my day amongst you. Ever. I mean, it's miraculous. Look at us. And it was the people that I first came to believe in. I must tell you, because I tried praying alone in a room and I felt hypocritical and uncertain and almost ashamed to be trying to do it. But when I lied in that bed and I put my head up, I would think of your faces. I would know where you sat and what you would say on a certain step, or I would hear your story enough times where if you paused, I could fill in the blanks, you know. And I came to love you. It's a strange thing that happens here. How we become friends and how we become respectful of one another. My life in Alcoholics Anonymous has taken all sorts of turns. I've had medical problems and financial difficulties and professional woes and this and that. And through it all, miraculously, what has been the centerpiece of my life has been Alcoholics Anonymous. All the time. It's been you. And it's always been you. From the very first day that I decided to stay with you, I sensed that there was something significant taking place in my life. And it wasn't me. If we all leave here later tonight and say you forget something and you walk back in, and if you were to sit down and try and reminisce or bring back the feeling that we have when we gather together, you would be hard-pressed to even try and recreate what we've just experienced with one another. That, my brothers and sisters, is the power of Alcoholics Anonymous. Where two or more are gathered. So I owe absolutely everything in my life to AA. Every kiss I get on the cheek from those grandchildren, every moment of peace, every time I could look into the eyes of a new man and tell him he need not drink anymore. With such certainty that only from experience could one say those words. You have given me a new life. And that is the promise that we give anyone that walks into these doors. And your work, your good work, is providing that to probably more people than you'll ever imagine. See, because if those grandkids of mine one of these days find out they have a problem with drinking, I want those doors to be open. And we're responsible for that. And I look around the room and I see a lot of young people. And it is in your hands that the torch will be passed. It is your responsibility to keep it open for the next generation. So I want to, again, thank you for your warm embrace since I'm here. And I want to thank Joan especially for a lot of time that you put up with me in the car and whatnot, and the committee for inviting me. And I want to leave you with this one thought that in the back of our book, it says we can only be defeated by a sense of intolerance or belligerent denial. And I can trump that. And I'll trump that by saying, if you've had enough trouble with booze, and if you're willing to even give this much of an effort, that you will find the power within these rooms that we call Alcoholics Anonymous. So I wish you a safe home if you're heading home. I wish you a good night's sleep. God bless you. Thank you for your love. Thank you for my sobriety. And God bless. Peace.